Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Eleanor Henderson. Henderson received her MFA in 2005 from the University of Virginia. Her fiction has appeared in many literary journals, including North American Review, Ninth Letter, and Columbia. Her short story, The Farms, was nominated for a Pushcart Award and was selected for the Best American Short Stories of 2009. Her debut novel, 10,000 Saints, will be released this month by Eco Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. Eleanor Henderson is an assistant professor in the writing department at Ithaca College. And welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Now, your biography states that you were born in Greece and grew up in Florida. Did your early years and early influences affect you to become a writer?
Well, only in the sense that I wanted to write about everything except Florida. I only was in Greece for about a year. My parents were living there. My father was working as an architect, so I have no memories of Greece. But growing up in Florida, you know, you don't meet a lot of writers. And so I grew up with the sense that the further north you got, the more culture you encountered. And I haven't really found much that's disproven that. So
Were you encouraged as a child?
Did I was you come encouraged
from parents
as a child.
Who
yeah.
saw that you liked to write?
Absolutely. My parents always had books around. You know, they're the kind of people who go to the library and go through several books a week. And my mother would record my early stories before I learned how to write. So I would, you know, copy the stories that I had read, and my mother would scribble them down for me, and I'd staple them into these little newsprint books. And I was very excited about the idea of producing books, and my parents encouraged me from a really early age. So there wasn't really a time that I didn't want to write, even if I grew up in a place that didn't really seem to be, you know, a sort of cultural mecca of literature.
Well, I think a lot of writers come from like a place of isolation almost for the literary world.
Yeah.
It might be a better place to come from.
I think that may be true. You know, if I'd taken for granted you know, being a part of a rich
New York culture
writers,
or something. You could have gotten lost.
That's right, yeah.
Well, did you start writing short stories immediately, or were you writing poems like many writers begin with?
I did start with some poems, but I was drawn to short stories fairly early, probably when I was 14 or 15. I started trolling the aisles of the bookstore and, you know, encountered literary magazines like Story Magazine, which is now defunct. I was so attracted to that magazine. And also read the short stories of the South early on. I think
Flannery O'Connor.
Flannery O'Connor, and even more contemporary writers that were on my mother's bookshelf, like Barbara Kingsolver and Lee Smith and Bobby Ann Mason. Those stories really spoke to me as a teenage girl. So I was drawn to short fiction. From a young age, I never really fancied myself much of a poet. Always wanted to tell stories.
Well, tell us about 10,000 Saints. The book is coming out soon. It takes place in the 1980s. Tell us a little bit about the plot and some of the main characters.
Well, I've described the book in a couple of ways. I think it's part coming of age and part coming to terms, for one thing, in the sense that it is about a young teenage boy, a 16-year-old boy named Jude, who grows up in Vermont and is attracted eventually to the straight edge movement in New York City. And so the book moves back and forth between Vermont
and New York. Explain what the straight edge movement. I was fascinated by that.
You know, some folks who I talk to about the book are familiar with it, but many have never heard of it before. The straight edge movement is still going strong, but the book centers on the sort of heyday of the movement in the late 1980s in New York City. Kids who identify themselves as straight edge, or people who identify themselves as straight edge, basically don't do drugs. So it's a rejection of drug use and also other kinds of excesses. So many people who identify themselves as straight edge don't drink alcohol, don't smoke cigarettes, don't eat meat, may not engage in premarital or promiscuous sex. And so the version of straight edge that my character Jude encounters is a sort of extremist straight edge culture that he embraces after having grown up in a sort of hippie town
with hippie parents from the 60s.
Right. And so he, you know, grew up with parents who condoned his drug use, or at least more than most parents would condone it. And after his friend dies of a drug overdose very early in the book, he begins to embrace this new lifestyle with the the dead friend's brother, who sort of encourages him and takes him under his wing mm-hmm. when he arrives in New York City to rehabilitate with his father, who happens to sell drugs on St. Mark's Place.
Yeah, it's a complicated book with a lot of different characters. Now, you go back and forth between Vermont and New York City. What kind of research did you have to do for this book? Also going back and forth between generations, which you do very well.
Thank you. I would say that most of the research that I did centered on trying to really craft this backdrop of New York City. So, you know, there was research into the straight edge movement as well, because at one point, it really was important to me to perform a kind of ethnography of that subculture. But what became a little more challenging was just reconstructing the city, because New York is not a city you want to get wrong.
and you were describing a city before it was gentrified, too,
right.
In the late 1980s.
So the book takes place in 1988, over about 9 months, and at that moment is so interesting to me because it is this moment where the East Village is becoming rapidly gentrified. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of culminating scene in the novel takes place at the Tompkins Square Park riots in August of 1988, which to me really represents this moment and that part of the city where a lot of different kinds of people are coming together and clashing and colliding in a way that my characters are also colliding in terms of their lifestyles and their
choices. It's an interesting convergence, and it brought back memories for me, because I was in San Francisco during the AIDS epidemic during the beginning of it.
Right. Wow.
And so your characters also deal with this, which is still new in the late 80s.
Right.
Dealing with the AIDS epidemic.
Right.
What got you interested in this subject? All of these subjects?
Well, it's not a very autobiographical book, but probably one of the ways that my own personal life enters the book is because my uncle, who lived in San Francisco, died of AIDS in 1990. And so he probably contracted AIDS early in New York and then in the 1980s. And and the AIDS thread really wasn't a part of the novel at first. It took many drafts for that to really find its home in the book. And now it feels like a natural fit to me, because it was, even though it was not talked about a lot, it really impacted especially this region of the city. Tompkins Square Park, not only was a dangerous place to be in general, but because of the drug use there, was an AIDS-ridden pocket of the city. And so it was important to me to document that. And the way that it sort of relates to the story is because of the kind of latent homosexual lifestyle that one of my characters is living. And so he encounters AIDS in a really brutal way the illness that one of his friends is suffering from.
It's got it. This book did bring back memories. I mean, all the closet cases.
Yeah.
People afraid to talk about their lifestyles and people afraid to come out at all.
Right. And I think it was 1984 that, Reagan finally uttered the word AIDS. And so this takes place a few years after that, but, the cases have been sort of established by this point.
And people were very angry at that point. That's when ACT UP started. I mean, people started getting really angry that the government was killing the gay community.
Right.
Yeah.
And, one bit of research that I did with my aunt, who was close to my uncle when he died, was, what would it be like to be a patient? What kind of confidentiality was there? And, at that point, the patients were numbers because everybody feared being identified by this disease.
And partners couldn't come in to see them.
Right.
And family didn't know they were gay. It was a mess. And you portray it great.
Thank you.
I wondered how you did your research on this.
Google is a wonderful thing, but it also is a dangerous thing in the sense that everyone has access to all kinds of information. Yeah. So, I think it was a challenge to try to limit the information, because when you start digging into a pocket of history that to me is so rich, you have to learn how to fictionalize and how to keep distance from the history.
I sense that you have good intuition, and I think that's why this is a good novel.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, because obviously you didn't live during these times.
I didn't.
Another subject that comes up front and center in this book is adoption.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us why that was part of this. You put so much into this, and it gels really naturally. I mean, there are so many subjects in this.
Yeah, thank you. I said that this isn't a very autobiographical novel, but probably the only other element other than my family's involvement in AIDS history is that my older brother is adopted.
Ah.
And So I knew from pretty early on in writing the novel that I wanted to write a character who was adopted. And I also knew that I wanted to write a story about the straight edge movement. And so as I was thinking about those two things over many months, it really occurred to me that the kind of character who would be drawn to this kind of family would be someone who felt not quite at home in his own family. Mm-hmm. And so he, this character Jude, feels as though he's kind of adopted into the wrong family.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, adoption isn't something that his parents talk about very much. And he, you know, doesn't know how to articulate it, but is searching, you know, as I think many people are, but perhaps some adopted people more than others,
yeah,
searching for some kind of belonging. And so
did you get that sense from your brother? Did you talk to your brother about it? Was he akin to the character in the book?
I didn't talk to him about it. And
really?
In fact, I was nervous about him reading the book because adoption wasn't something we talked about very much in my family. And I think that's a generational marker, too. I mean, you know, lots of people have different experiences of adoption. But I think today we treat adoption so openly. There's so much open adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, the sort of psychological tools, you know, to know how to raise adopted children and how to talk as a family about adoption. And it wasn't something that we talked about because he was, you know, so much my brother. But at the same time, it was isolating in a way, I think, because we didn't really have the language to talk about
mm-hmm.
it. And so I think that that's something that is happening in the book, too.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Now, the teens and the adults in your book, they almost seem innocent, even though they're not doing innocent things.
Right.
I mean, the father's selling marijuana and so on. But where did this come from? I mean, there's an innocence and a longing in most of these characters,
mm-hmm.
both generations, all generations. Tell us where that came from.
I'm not sure where it came from because I haven't necessarily encountered people like Jude's parents in my life, but I know people who have been raised by parents who have had you know, checkered pasts, who have made a lot of mistakes. I mean, my parents were about as straight-laced as they come, so this is entirely fictional, I promise.
I was wondering about that. I was thinking maybe it was your grandparents.
No, my mom still talks about, you know, one marijuana cigarette she had in 1969. So they were probably a little appalled by these depictions, but they're really fictional. But, you know, a lot of my friends' parents, you know, were heavily involved in the 60s, you know,
mm-hmm.
so. And for these characters, those choices have kind of clung to them, and some of the characters have moved further away from that lifestyle into more, you know, responsible adulthood. But for some, it hasn't, and there's a lot of, you know, innocence, perhaps, but also a lot of guilt, I think, on perhaps mm-hmm. a lot of the characters.
But they also seem good-hearted, which I find fascinating, too.
Well, it's easy for me to empathize with people. You know, I think that everyone has an interesting story, and even people who make a lot of mistakes are redeemable. And for me, that's what's interesting about fiction, and that's what fiction can expose, is the humanity in people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Eleanor Henderson. We're talking about her forthcoming book, 10,000 Saints. Now, I want to ask you this. Did you feel close to these characters? Tell us how you started feeling about them, because they are so alien, obviously, to who you are and
mm-hmm.
who your family is in many ways.
I did feel very close to them. I think when you spend as much time on a book as I did, which is about 8 years, you know, that can be trying because you want to finish the book. But at the same time, I think I had so much invested in these characters that I did become very close to them and wanted to keep them around for a while in my life. And, you know, I tell my students that they should be thinking about their characters all the time. They should think about them before they go to bed. They should, you know, they should like their characters, you know, and that takes some time to develop, but
yeah.
I did feel close to them, and I hope that readers feel close to them. That's the hope, I think, of most fiction writers.
Did you change in any way while you were writing this? It seems very consistent, even though it was over 8 years,
mm-hmm.
but it must have changed you somehow writing this huge novel.
Yeah, I would say it did change me, and the book changed a lot, too. The
mm-hmm.
book transformed a lot. And, you know, I began it when I was pretty young. I was just out of college, living in New York for the year after college. And, you know, so I was teaching myself how to write a novel. And so, you know, I think I changed as a person and as a writer. And for the better, you know, I wasn't too anxious to finish the book because I felt as though I needed to sort of mature as a writer in order to tell the story that I wanted to tell. And so the book went through many drafts and many versions and grew and shrunk, and I probably did a little of that myself.
Uh-huh. I assume you had people who were looking at it through the years and,
I did.
And giving you guidance.
Yeah, I began it shortly before I began the MFA program at the University of Virginia, where I got a tremendous amount of support and feedback from my peers and from my professors there. And so even though it's sort of a difficult thing to workshop a novel in a graduate program, it ended up being a very good container for that book because I had, you know, that support system in place and people who are telling me to keep going, which is important.
Yeah, yeah. Now that you've written a novel, do you have the bug? Or are you going to go back to short stories? Are you going to still continue to...
Short stories have become a little more alien to me. I'm one of those writers who think that short stories are harder to write than novels.
I think they are, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're difficult. A number of writers have spoken about the sort of... perfection of the short story or the perfection of the poem. There's something about the short story form that is so challenging.
You have to use a real economy of words.
Right.
And in the novel, you can sort of float around if you need to.
Right, and the novel is inevitably imperfect, and I think that's what draws many people to that form. Not that I'm much of an expert at this point, but I do have the novel bug.
Uh-huh. I can imagine that you probably do. You get to live with all these people for a number of years.
Well, readers want to live inside novels for a long time for the same reason, and I think writers want to as well.
Yeah, I can tell you took great care with this novel. It's really an impressive first effort, I have to say.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Now you're an assistant professor. What do you think the basic tools are that you need to teach people who are aspiring writers now that you're teaching?
I talked a little bit about empathy for characters. I mean, I think that's a pretty basic skill, empathy for characters and character development. What's interesting to me as a writer, beyond the sort of basic skills of characterization, plot development, is point of view, though. And I find that to be the more difficult craft technique for students to learn and for me to learn and to teach. And that was something that I struggled with over the course of writing the book. The point of view has to be right. It has to, you have to be able to find the access to your own story. And so when I began the book, it began as a third-person limited perspective.
Really?
540 pages of a 16-year-old boy, which can get a little
claustrophobic. We can understand why it was edited differently.
That's right. That's right. And so, I had realized by the time that I finished that I needed some space it took me a while, though, to realize that this was going to be a book that was told from multiple points of view. So I think there are about 8 points of view now. So I really just took a sledgehammer to that approach and ended up inviting in many more voices, which I think kind of adds to that ensemble cast, which I think is really defines the book now. I think a writer, a student who has a grasp of point of view, has accomplished something. That's something that I still struggle with.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about dealing with time in a novel? The thought of writing a novel seems like an alien world. I write poetry and political essays and stuff. But writing a novel seems such a daunting task.
Well, management of time fascinates me, too. I'm actually teaching a senior seminar next year on the art of managing time, which I think is something that a lot of beginning writers don't think about and that I'm just beginning to get a sense of, and not just in terms of choosing the frame for your story. I mean, this is a pretty straightforward frame. It takes place over 9 months in 1988. It's fairly linear. There's one, flashback chapter, but for the most part, we have these characters in the present moment. But, the management of time within a scene, within a paragraph, can create an entire universe for your reader, can create a sort of mental space for your character, space that the reader inhabits, too. And so, I think when people think about management of time, they sort of think about whether their story is going to take place over a weekend or over 100 years. Mm-hmm. And that obviously is an important choice. But I think the more technical and more difficult choice a writer makes takes place sentence by sentence. The time that we're living in isn't necessarily the time that a character's mind is alive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I would think the challenge would be the people who try to do something in one evening. I mean, a lot of playwrights do that.
Right.
That seems like a daunting task as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm up for that one.
Now, do you read reviews? Do you think reviews are important? How are you affected by them?
I don't have an official answer to that quite yet, but...
Were your short stories reviewed?
Not much, actually. You know, short stories don't get nearly as much attention as the novel has gotten so far. So, you know, I feel incredibly lucky that anyone is reading the book, you know, finishing it in order to review it. And so, in general, I have been reading the more major reviews that have come out. I'm trying to stay off of Goodreads and Amazon.com because those can keep you up at night.
those are, for people who don't know, that they... It's for fans of books, and they give away free copies of forthcoming novels, and they let people review them.
That's right.
And give them stars.
That's right. And so, which is exciting and scary at the same time. I mean, their readers have the right to review as much as anyone else.
Do you think you'll want to answer back if somebody has something incorrect?
I think I'm going to have to try to be hands-off. I did read a review recently that criticized, the sort of secondhand nature of a lot of my stories. You know, I wasn't part of the straight edge movement. Mm. I didn't live in New York during that time. And so a lot of it I'm getting through secondhand stories and through research and through imagination. But the one thing that this person criticized was the one thing that I actually did experience, which was playing video games, playing, you know, Nintendo growing up with my brothers. And I thought I had the language down, but apparently...
Well, how did they know that you hadn't experienced this? So that isn't really all over the place. I had to look it up to find out how old you were.
I don't know. I mean, this particular reviewer, you know, I haven't read this a lot, felt that I was writing as an outsider. And I think I am writing as an outsider. You know, I think there's a certain outsider quality to the omniscient narrator that, you know, to me is an interesting choice, so that we can see all these characters engaged in this world, but not necessarily commit to one particular point of view.
But most novelists are not writing from experience. You know, I mean, Joyce Carol Oates is a great example.
Sure.
She's written about girl gangs and the Chappaquiddick case. And, you know, so writers always use their imagination.
I hope so. I hope that writers continue to use their imagination. It would be disappointing if they didn't.
Well, what do you hope people will take from this book?
I hope that they'll appreciate the portrait of this period. I suppose I hope that they will become interested in this sort of pocket of the subculture in terms of the straight edge movement. But I hope that they will be fulfilled by a good story, about people that they can relate to. And I think the book is broad enough to include a number of different kinds of experiences. So, you know, at one point I worried whether women could really appreciate the novel, whether adults, you know, older folks could really appreciate the novel. But I think now that it is, you know, sort of in its full form, I've heard at least early on that different kinds of readers have been attracted to the book. And so that's really rewarding for me so far.
Yeah. Well, I think people are interested in serious fiction. You know, I mean, everything is put in little corners.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people are, and this feels like a serious piece of fiction to me.
I hope so. You know, I think it began as less serious. You know, when I began it, I thought, I want to write a book about boys. I want this book to be fun. You know, I grew up with two skateboarding brothers and was just, you know, attracted to the sort of energy and testosterone of teenage boys. And, then I think as I grew up, the book grew up too. And so it's taken me a while to realize that, you know, this is a serious book. This isn't just it's not just a book about coming of age. It's, you know, it's about generation coming of age.
Yeah. Was it hard for you to let this baby go in some ways? You know, let the world start judging it? Because I know people say they get attached to their characters.
It wasn't hard for me. I couldn't wait to get it off my desk.
Really?
Yeah. I was ready. To let it out of the nest. No, it's definitely a surreal experience to see people actually reading it. I think when writers are living with their characters, they're their own, and you know, maybe a few other readers have access to them, but they're still alive only in their minds. And so it's certainly a strange experience to see people, you know, with the book
and they're judging your family, your book. Yes.
Sure, it's difficult, but I feel incredibly lucky that it is on a bookshelf. somewhere. Still have to pinch myself.
Oh, yeah, that has to be gratifying. That has to be very gratifying. To tell us what influences you've had in your life in regard to writers. Who stands out?
My favorite contemporary writer has got to be Michael Chabon. He inspires me for a number of reasons, but the book that really... that really hit me was The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which I read as I was beginning this book in 2001, I guess, living in New York, and you know, realized in some way that I wanted to write a big New York book about, you know, boys getting into trouble, but also a book that had a sort of historical shadow. I'm not quite sure I made the connection at that point, but that certainly was a book that was on my mind as I was reading. And, you know, he's such an inventive and unpredictable writer, and he's such an impressive prose stylist. I mean, his sentences are just incredibly luscious but incredibly sharp. So he's a writer that I admire greatly. But I love the short stories of Laurie Moore. I love the novels of Jonathan Lethem. Mm-hmm. I'm a realist to the core, but I do love books that have imagination, but also have a sense of sharpness, of awareness of a sentence that is doing just what it should be doing.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, your short story, The Farms, got a lot of attention, and you know, was nominated for a Pushcart and so on. Does that affect you when you get nominated and you see that something really is successful? Does that change you in any way?
The Pushcart nomination was incredibly delightful, but what really changed, you know, if anything did, was the Best American Short Stories anthology, mm-hmm. which, you know, I'd been collecting since I was 15, and have always just read cover to cover and, you know, pored over those contributors' notes. So to get that email out of the blue that my story had been accepted when you don't even know that it was under consideration was incredibly gratifying, and not that it necessarily made a difference in terms of the fate of the novel, but that, you know, that gave me a bit of validation when I needed it. And you know, that was a short story that had been rejected by probably 40 literary magazines before it ended up at Agni. And
isn't that amazing?
And now to find that a couple of other readers have liked it too is enough to sort of, you know, to put it on the shelves, and now it's going to be a short film apparently.
Wow, that's really so validating. I mean, that must make you feel, I really am a writer, I'm going to stick with this, you know, I'm starting to get this kind of attention.
Yeah. That's right. Well, especially at the time I really needed it, because, you know, I had this big novel on my desk and was having a hard time getting an agent, and knew that it needed that last revision, and, you know, at the time I had a young baby at home and was trying to teach at the same time, and so, you know, having the "yes, you are a writer" email is always nice for a writer to get.
Well, Eleanor, we only have about a minute left. I understand you're working on another novel. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure, I'll tell you a little about it. It's set in Georgia during the Depression, and it follows the life of a sharecropping family. And it's very different from this first book. I thought that I wanted to write something more contemporary, but it turns out that I also have the historical fiction bug. So we'll see how it goes. I'm early on in the process.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, we'll look forward to that. Eleanor Henderson, thank you so much for joining us. And again, the book is called 10,000 Saints. Go out and get it. It's really good. Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.